Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we talk about three works of fiction. Later in the hour, we talk with Martha Hall Kelly about her novel, The Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club. Cape Cod author Peter Abrahams, a.k.a. Spencer Quinn, joins us to talk about his second novel featuring Mrs. Plansky. But first, Judith Newcomb-Stiles joins us. Her novel is titled Hush, Little Fire. Welcome, Judith.
Hello. Good morning.
You touch on so many themes in this book: abortion, adoption, substance abuse, secrets. Where did the idea for the story come from?
Well, to be honest, it came from stories I've heard from my family over the years. It's not a memoir. I had to change things up so I wouldn't change names, so I wouldn't piss off my relatives. But I worked in a pottery studio in New York for 27 years with 10 people every day, all noise. And then I moved to Cape Cod and work alone. So all these stories just started flooding into my head. And I didn't even realize I was writing a book. I just started writing them down. And then I thought, you know, I really want people to think about these things. I want them to think about what it was like before Roe v. Wade in a small town.
Yeah. Now, you know that there are two sets of Newcombs, those that end with an E and those that don't. So tell us the difference.
Okay. Well, there are the upstanding Newcombs without the E at the end of their name, such as Benjamin Oliver Newcomb, who rescued the crew of a foundering ship in 1851. So they named the beach after him. That's the upstanding Newcombs. And they dropped the E at the end of their name to distinguish themselves from the naughty Newcombs. The naughty Newcombs have an E at the end of their name, and they're usually getting in trouble with things like, you know, drugs and stealing. And they had a parking lot named after them. That's about it.
All right. So Mary Newcomb is probably what we call the main character, with and this is Mary Newcomb with an E, right? And she comes home
without
for Christmas
without an E.
Yeah. All right. She comes home for Christmas with her 12-year-old son, and Mary struggles with identity. She's adopted. Talk a little bit about Mary.
Well, Mary is a fictional character. I say that the whole entire book is 100% fiction, so I won't get in trouble with my relatives, because I have many 40-plus Newcomb cousins around the Cape who I love very much, and I don't want them to be mad at me or embarrass them. But she, Mary Newcomb with an E, was adopted and was in a lifelong search for who her birth mother was. And the family, when a family keeps those secrets, they turn the family tree into a pricker bush. It gets very messy. And I found out after I wrote this book how common that was.
Yeah. You didn't usually tell children back in that time that they were adopted, right? So her mom is Birdie. Tell us about Birdie.
Well, Birdie is a secretive person. She does not ever talk to her daughter about the truth of the family, about why she was adopted, where she was adopted from. And that's where the messy stuff begins. It begins in every family that way, by keeping secrets. And she sort of led the life of a quote unquote housewife on Cape Cod, you know, minding her own business, but really getting involved in a lot of gossip. But, you know, raising this adopted child, wife of a doctor who was very popular, who actually gave out secret abortions. Everybody knew it, but nobody knew it, type thing. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of her life, like in just out of the blue, she takes a painting class with her sister-in-law in Provincetown and discovers painting. She discovers the joy of painting and creating, and she's just so overwhelmed she forgets to deal with her family and paints in the kitchen and goes to bed smelling like turpentine. And that's actually based on a real person in my life. I changed the name and the whole story of it because people are very proprietary about their stories, especially children of people. So that I didn't want her children in real life to be proprietary about this and get into how I was telling her story. So I changed up her story, but the point of the story is not who it was. The point of the story is that in midlife, it's the most wonderful, exciting thing when a woman discovers creating, writing, art, painting, and Birdie discovers it in Provincetown. Meanwhile, her sister-in-law's running off and shagging the painting teacher.
All right. So, in the beginning of the book, there's a fire, and it's a suspicious fire. It burns down the health clinic. Mary doesn't remember much about that night as she had a little too much eggnog, right? So, this fire becomes pretty central to the story.
Yes, I'm kind of like a murder mystery junkie. For 30 years, I watched the PBS mysteries, and I'd be on the phone with my best friend in Woodstock, trying to figure out who did it, and being very, very critical of the stories, especially like Broadchurch when they had the culprit come on into the story at the end, and that was cheating in my view and my friend Joyce's view. So I worked very hard on creating a straight line mystery in which I could weave in the really big subjects such as heaven and hell, adoption, abortion, alcoholism, family secrets. But I stuck with the straight line mystery and worked very hard on setting up red herrings and then really thoughtfully picking the ending on who actually started the fire because it raises a big question. And I won't spoil it for you, but the question is, how far will a person go to protect their own? Like if my father knew that I had been involved in illegal activities, would he turn me in or would he not? And when I asked people at book clubs to raise their hand, if they would turn their family member in, nobody raises their hand. It's really interesting. It's like a moral compass.
And Mary does become a suspect, but she's just, one of them, right? And as you mentioned, I thought it was really interesting because also a fan of mystery. As you read along, you go, ah, I know who did it, right? Then you go, wait a minute. And you read a little more, you go, no, it's this person. And you aren't really sure until the end.
That's so
So
great. That's exactly what I wanted, but I didn't want it just for that purpose. I wanted all arrows to lead to the big question, how far would you go to protect your own? And the deal is, this is Reader's Honor System. If you read this book and guess correctly who started the fire, you come to the Newcomb Ch Hollow Shop, my shop in Wellfleet, and you get free chocolate for the rest of your life. And so far, nobody cashed
I have
in.
a feeling nobody's going to really be able to guess that. So, and part of this, Mary learns that her father had performed abortions at the clinic before Roe versus Wade. That's something she did not know. We learn a lot about, as you said, family secrets. But you tell this story from the perspectives of four women: Mary, Birdie, we have Nurse Barbara and Lisa, and there's also some chapters by Walter. But tell us a little bit about Nurse Barbara. Who is Nurse Barbara?
Oh, Nurse Barbara. Nurse Barbara is part me, part people I know who are here in Wellfleet and they've turned 65 and they're completely broke. They have no money. Nurse Barbara worked at this clinic for, years and years. They're forcing her out into retirement. She doesn't have any money, so what does she do? She turns to stealing drugs and selling them, and this is another moral compass area. Like you think, oh, I would never do that. But if you're in a situation, and there are people here in Wellfleet who are in this situation, there are a lot of people over 60 who are completely broke and they go to the food banks, they get their food there, but they don't have any money. So what do they do? All kinds of things. Nurse Barbara, the moral compass gets sort of put in the wearing blender and exploded because, in her mind, she had a right to those drugs. She worked there 40 years. She was entitled to have her hands on them and do whatever she wanted because, the crime, the criminal starts playing with their moral compass and justifies what they're doing. That's a big part of this book. The act of having the clinic burned down, the culprit begins to justify why she did something so hideous.
All right, Lisa, tell us about Lisa. Who's Lisa?
Okay. Lisa is also totally fiction, but actually, in my mind, I always writing Lisa, I saw my younger daughter. My younger daughter, she's in graduate school now for filmmaking. She's made some wonderful films, but she did the hustle. She did the hustle of waitressing, cleaning houses, sort of like, on the ladder of whatever. She's was down there with being ignored and disparaged as a waitress and a house cleaner, which really isn't fair in this world. And that happens a lot. There's this underbelly in Wellfleet of service workers and Jamaican guest workers who are underappreciated and unseen. People don't see them. They come here, they go on vacation, they have a lovely time, but they don't see that the kitchen in the restaurant that they love is 100 degrees with people working in it, no air conditioning. That's my deal breaker. If a restaurant has a hot kitchen and people are working in there, I don't go there.
And then we have a few chapters from Walter. Walter went to school with Mary. He's got a little bit of a crush on Mary.
Well, I actually have a crush on Walter, and Walter has a. But, they were high school friends. They weren't boyfriend, girlfriend, but they had both discovered the magic of making things, of drawing, of making pottery. And then Walter's mother, who is Mildred, who's, really a difficult person, forced him to go into the police department. He's really not a cop at heart. He's an artist at heart. But he works year after year, decade after decade in Wellfleet, and all of a sudden his old friend Mary comes back to Wellfleet, and she's a potter. She's been working as a potter all these years. And he's smitten. He wants to have a relationship with her, but she doesn't see it. She's like oblivious. But Walter, in the audiobook, Spotify bought the audiobook, and we had a big discussion about how many readers there would be. And they wanted one reader, and I wanted five because there are five points of view. So they let me, it was great, pick three of them. And I picked my son-in-law, who's from Canada, who's just a wonderful voice. And I realized, oh yeah, I thought of him to read because that's actually who I envisioned his face when I was writing Walter. So what was cool about it is my son-in-law, Preston Cook, is from Canada with a Canadian accent. Nobody even asked him to, go Boston, go New England when you narrate, but he figured out on his own the Boston accent, New England accent, Cape Cod. And so he says things like ca and other things.
Oh, that's
So
funny.
I'm so happy with that.
Why
So
did you
happy.
decide to write this in the five different perspectives rather than just one point of view? Why did you decide to do those alternating chapters?
Well, I worked on this book for 8 years because I'm a potter. I am very busy, but I would find time and I would work on this book. And, halfway through, maybe year four, all of a sudden these Birdie, Walter, Lisa, Nurse Haskins, we're saying we don't want to be in the third person. We want you, the reader, to be in our head, to be in our life. It just evolved that way. And then I kind of panicked. I thought, oh, does anybody do that? So does anybody write first person point of view from five points of view? So I, went to the library. I literally scoured the library and I found one or two books where they had multiple first person point of view. And I said, great, I can do this.
Right. So lots of family secrets reveal themselves. It's somewhat of a dark tale, a mystery. Tell us about your writing process. You said it took you 8 years. You started one way, then the voices said, nope, we want our own chapters. This is your first novel, right? So do you write every
Yeah,
day? What, tell us about your
I
process.
wrote essays and news articles for the Villager newspaper and an Italian newspaper. So this book was born out of an essay that I wrote for Italy.com and out of Venice in 2022 about before Roe v. Wade was overturned, when everybody said, "Oh, it's a done deal. It's etched in stone." And I said, "I didn't think so." And I wrote this article called Who is the Boss of Her Body? And it talks about the very early on efforts in different states, Missouri, to get rid of Roe v. Wade and make abortions difficult. And then I wove in the news, and it's actually true that in Europe, in Norway, they were developing fake wombs, faux wombs, which are plastic bags with amniotic fluid. And all of a sudden, in the future, the pregnancy abortion issue could be a moot point because you'll see in the book, when you read the book, the grandmother talks about why it will be a moot point. And that was triggered by this article and working alone in my pottery studio, thinking of these stories. And then I just, after I wrote the article, I just kept writing.
So I think you sort of touched on this, but what is it that you hope readers take away from this story?
Yes, well, publishing a book is the act of saying, here you are, readers, this is what I want you to think about. That's what I hope books will be. There are a lot of fluffy books out there right now that just kind of tell a story and then you can't remember what you read. So I don't understand that whole genre of writing, but there are many big things I wanted the reader to think about that I think about, such as heaven and hell. Okay, so I grew up, in a sort of quasi-Unitarian family, and they don't really talk about heaven and hell, but everybody else did. So I have a scene where Jimmy is drunk and he's holding a vodka bottle upside down and he's telling Lisa, because he reads a lot, he tells Lisa about things he read about the universe. And then he tells her that heaven and hell only exists in the last 7 seconds of your mind before you die, and then there is nothing. And that's a whole big sort of mental gymnastics that Lisa did after he spoke with her. So I know I live in this community of older people. I know they're think I just did a book talk yesterday where we were talking about, well, is it heaven or hell, or is it nothing, or is it Buddhist? It's on people's minds. And I wanted to bring it up, and I wanted especially the whole pro-choice, pro-life debate to come up without judgment. For example, I have a woman named Trudy who has four daughters and is pregnant again and needs an abortion. And she's in the bomb shelter bar trying to do tricks to get money to pay for her kids and is hounding Nurse Haskins to give her an abortion because she's too late in the pregnancy to go to Boston for a legal abortion. And she says, I believe in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, but the Holy Ghost isn't going to babysit for me. So I wanted people to think about that. Okay, so you could be totally against abortion, but what about this? And no money.
A lot of issues you touch on, lots to think about. The book is Hush, Little Fire. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Judith Newcomb-Stiles, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, well, it was great to meet you because I've always been a big fan of your show, your radio talks. I love them.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. Coming up after a break, a novel set on the vineyard in World War II. Stay with us. You're listening to The Point. Martha Hall Kelly is author of the Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club. Welcome, Martha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So the book is fiction, but it's based on factual events.
Yes. It is called the Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club.
I have it
Look
too.
at those sticky notes. Oh my God, you actually read it.
I
That's
did.
fabulous. And my mom grew up on Martha's Vineyard. Her family, the Smiths, my great grandfather came there in 1891. So the house is still there that she grew up in. And I just decided to write about World War II from her point of view, because she told us so many great stories about growing up there. She was 14 at the time of the war. And my grandmother had lost her husband. And was raising four little kids and used to make donuts and sell them for 25 cents a dozen, if you can believe it. I don't know how she made any money, but out front of her house on State Road on Martha's Vineyard in West Tisbury, And the servicemen would come by in their jeeps and stop and buy the donuts. So she used to talk about how wonderful they were and so handsome. And she couldn't go to all the dances and things because she was too young. But I just thought, I think that would be a really great novel because there was a lot going on out on Martha's Vineyard at that time. There were U-boats all over, Nazi U-boats. People don't realize that. A lot of people don't. The surrounding waters trying to take down Liberty ships and other, allied ships. And also all sorts of spy stuff happening. So I thought, let's talk about that because I think that's been kind of lost to time.
So, was your grandmother's house then the inspiration for Copper Farm?
Yes, Copper Pond Farm. Theirs was a flower farm, and today that house is still there, and they have all sorts of animals. But yeah, that's the inspiration. I used to babysit when I was a teenager at this wonderful. So sorry. You can't really call it a farm, but it was more like an estate, and it was called Soundings, and it is still there today. And my sister-in-law rented it 1 year. It's right on, the bluff overlooking the water. So I kind of combined my family's farm with Soundings, if that makes sense, and created this, kind of my idyllic place on the vineyard.
So let's talk about the main characters, sisters, Briar and Candace, very different people, and based on your mom, right?
Cadence is based on my mom. Yeah.
So tell us about these two sisters.
Cadence is the older one. She's 19. And Briar is the younger one. She's kind of neurodivergent, very, they're like chalk and cheese, as my dad used to say, very different sisters. Cadence is, very beautiful and, kind of more typical and really, really loves reading. She wants to go to New York City and be in publishing, just like my mother was a huge reader and wanted to get off of the island so badly. She was really desperate to get off of Martha's Vineyard. She wanted to see the world. She eventually did when she met my father, who came from Arlington. And then Cadence is not inspired by anybody really in my family. I just created her. She's actually my favorite character too. She's just a 16-year-old who is really, really smart and keeps seeing Nazi U-boats, and she knows that's what they are.
Yeah, and
But
you said, I want to say you said Cadence, but you mean Briar.
Oh, did I
You
say
said
Cadence?
Cadence,
Yes,
but
Briar.
I want the
Yes.
listeners to know it's Briar we're talking about.
Yes, Briar, the younger one, is this like super brainy, really into like war stuff. So, and she finds somebody on the beach that washes up.
So
German person.
why did you decide to write this in alternate chapters from the different points of view?
I've done that in all of my books. I just feel like it keeps things moving and interesting. For me, with just one protagonist, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could do it, but it would be kind of a short book. I really, I when I read too, I love to think I have like reading ADD or something. I get kind of bored quickly. So for me, it's really nice to be able to, and also those point of views, they can look at each other, if that makes sense. So, it's like you don't have to have those mirror moments where characters are like, this is what I look like. You can talk about the other characters, which for me is really helpful.
A major theme of this book is the importance of books, especially in troubling times, which we seem to be.
Yes, it's back.
So, talk about that theme of the importance of books.
Well, again, my mother inspired that. She was just like a crazy reader, and I love to read, but she was off the charts. And she lived around the corner from the dump, and that's where she got her books. The summer people would come and drop off their big cartons of books, and that's what she read. And so the importance of books was once she got old enough to afford her own books, she was really a maniac about books and keeping them and making sure she got them back if she lent them to people, and she had a book club. So I think she really appreciated it once she could like actually go and buy an actual book. So that inspired the books in the book, because I originally I wasn't gonna base this on my family, and then I had this kind of epiphany where I thought, you know what? I'm going to make this my actual family. Because at first, I was kind of reluctant to write about my actual family. I for a lot of reasons, you know, there was a lot of alcoholism in there, and they were poor, and I don't, I was kind of reluctant about it. But then eventually, I just said, okay, I'm just going to write about them. And once I did that, the book thing just kind of came out because my mother was so into books. I
And it's
think
not, and it's not all, I mean, it's just, it's fictionalized. So it's, you know, not everything in the book is true. So you can still write about your family, and you don't know what's really your family and what's fiction, right?
right, but for me, once I did start writing about my actual family, like my uncle that was shot down over Messina, Italy, and my actual grandmother, and it really changed it. It made it way more interesting for me to live with all of them. And, you know, there's nothing like writing about the truth. I always say in all my books, if there's a choice, if you can write about the real thing or something that's made up, I always go with the real thing. So it really helped give it some teeth, I think.
And so you mentioned that the events during World War II, they mirror what actually happened at that time on the vineyard. So you had to do some research here to see exactly what was going on.
I did. I was really lucky. There's a wonderful historian who wrote a wonderful book with two other authors, and it's called Martha's Vineyard During World War II, and his name is Tom Dresser. He helped me a lot. And I had always known certain things happened. Like my mom told me that there were submarine or U-boats around the island at night. They would go to sleep, and if they were near the ocean, they could hear, like in Vineyard Haven, for example, they could hear the U-boats come up to the surface and recharge their batteries, the hum at night. And it was really creepy. So she used to talk about that kind of a thing, but it wasn't until I wrote the book that I had to confirm it all. And Tom Dresser really helped me a lot with that. One of her best friends is still alive, which, I mean, she's well into her 90s. Her name is Shirley Kennedy, and she's just lovely. But she won't tell me how old she is, but I can kind of do that. But she was really helpful because she's a first, you know, a primary source, as they say in journalism. And I went right to the source and got all sorts of great information from her. She told me lots of things about my mother too that my mother had kind of left out. Yeah, boyfriends and things. It was really fascinating.
As it was interesting, you note that the waters and beaches of Cape Cod and Martha's Vineyard were ideal for training the amphibians because they mocked the invasion of August 1942, right? I mean, it's the conditions are, it's a great place for that.
Well, that really surprised me that they did a mock invasion, actually a couple from Falmouth, over at Camp Edwards. They sent over amphibious boats, and those were really new at the time, you know, the invasion barges that they invaded Normandy with, and they were practicing. And, you know, they didn't tell the islanders. And all the top brass from Washington came up and stood on the bluffs overlooking Lambert's Cove Beach and, you know, the North Shore beaches. And they invaded early in the morning. And their goal was to get to the airport. And, you know, as if they were landing on the beaches at Normandy and going inshore. And that's what they did. They made it to the airport. And people talked about, you know, like in Vineyard Haven and in town. Like looking out into their garden and seeing soldiers with their full backpacks kind of going through the on their bellies, crawling through the grass, getting to Edgartown to the airport. Yeah, so they did it. I do think it's kind of sad though that here they were practicing on Martha's Vineyard and then when they got to the real thing, how
Oh.
horribly,
Oh, yeah.
what a heinous situation that was, and almost half of them didn't come home.
Yeah.
My mom used to talk about how sad they were that they practiced there for Normandy, and then they lost so many of their boys, they called them, not from the vineyard necessarily, but from all over the place, because Pekin Hill was an army base there.
Yeah. Now, poor Breyer, who would report her sightings of the U-boat that no one believed she really saw. And, liar, Breyer.
Oh, Briah the Liar,
Yeah.
I guess we would say it in Boston speak.
Yeah.
South Shoreman speak.
I think Breyer's my favorite character as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
I just, she's just this plucky kid, right? I mean, and she gets in, and we're not going to give a lot away here. She gets involved in some mysterious stuff, right?
Yeah.
Which is always fun. We love spying and mystery, and of course, there's also a love story.
Gotta have that to keep me interested as a writer. I put Gill in there because I was when I learned that there were British officers that Lord Mountbatten sent over to kind of teach the Yanks how to fight, I thought, why not? That's always good.
So one of the things you have in the book is this idea for these small books that they would give to, because the soldiers can't carry around these big hard copy books or even, they, so there's this idea that we're going to make these small books, and they were pulled from Graham's Cookie Jar, right? The titles. This is also based in fact, and I did not know that.
The Armed Services Editions. That was one of the most fun things that I found. They're tiny.
Tiny, yeah.
And they're smaller than a paperback. When I found out that these were, I love thinking that, there was a soldier reading this in a foxhole somewhere. When I found out that the US government had printed 1.5 million of these little guys and gave them to every soldier. While the Nazis were burning books in Germany, we were doing this. And I loved that so much. And I wanted to. The true story is they, like two men in the army library or something came up with it, but I decided to give it to Cadence, like make it her idea. And when I found out that they pulled the titles from a cookie jar, I thought, oh, well, that's perfect. Graham is a baker. I'll give her the cookie jar. So it seemed like kind of a nice fit. But it's so sad that the soldiers on the invasion barges that were invading Normandy, landing on the beaches there, every soldier had one of these little books in their backpack, in their pack. And, half of them didn't get to read their books. But it was an amazing thing to think that men could, get everything that you get from a book while they were in a foxhole or in combat. It's pretty amazing. One of the books actually helped a group of soldiers that were cornered in France. It helped them get out of that town because the book actually was about the town that they were in. Isn't
Oh,
that just
wow.
so amazing?
Yeah.
So it helped them in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Talk about weaving this narrative around real events and how to decide what to keep as fact and what to elaborate on as fiction.
Oh, that's always so hard. I'm writing a book now about rock and roll in the 1970s on Martha's Vineyard. And it's so hard to figure out, what to keep and what to fictionalize. But in this one, it was somewhat easy because I went, as I said before, with all the real stuff, and I just kind of plugged my characters into it. I didn't have a lot of issues. That's the nice thing about fiction. I thought I'm going to have a guy wash up on the beach. I can't say too much about that guy because he is critical to the plot, but I just made it what I felt like making it. I mean, that's the real. Sometimes people say, well, why didn't you? My first book, Lilac Girls, was, based on a true story as well. And people used to always ask me, why didn't you just go with the real? Why didn't you write it as nonfiction? And I just thought, There is no way I can do that. I'm just not that writer. I mean, to me, the fun part is all the stuff that you can make it come alive so much more easily when you can, put things in there that weren't necessarily, otherwise, you can read a New York Times article about it.
Yeah. And so it's great too, because at the end in the author notes, you talk about the real, the factual stuff. So as, because sometimes I find that, especially when I'm reading historical fiction, I go, wait, is that true? So
Oh.
like this thing with the small books, who knew, right? I mean, I had no idea that they did that. So the author notes, I think, are really important too at the end.
Well, that's good to hear, because with my next book, I'll make sure I put, because every time I finish a book, I think, do I really have to do that? Because I'm usually, need to like go take a nap. But I think it people have come to expect that. And when I read, I really like to look at, what was true and what wasn't. It's fun.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add about this, the story, that what you hope people take away from it?
Oh my goodness. I just hope people, I mean, for me, what I loved about writing it was going back to that time, 1940s on Martha's Vineyard. I wasn't born until the 1950s, but I feel like it was a similar, kind of a vibe from when what I remember when I was little. And I just feel like that really, to me, is the greatest generation. It felt like everyone at that time, with a few exceptions, Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh, maybe, who were isolationists, everybody really felt on the same page. They were all pulling at the same oar. And I really wanted to celebrate that and make, because I think we've forgotten in a way these days what that was like to all be together in something. So I hope that people just really enjoy kind of time traveling to that time, and also just to remember that, we don't have to be that divided.
I will say it is definitely a time travel, very much so.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
I love that.
The book is The Martha's Vineyard Beach and Book Club, author Martha Hall Kelly. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after a break, Cape Cod author Peter Abrahams, aka Spencer Quinn, talks about his latest novel. You're listening to The Point. Peter Abrahams, aka Spencer Quinn, is the author of Mrs. Plansky Goes Rogue. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
All right, so this is the second in the series. So what prompted this second series?
The first one is called Mrs. Plansky's Revenge. And what prompted it was I had so much fun writing that character, Mrs. Plansky, who's a 71-year-old retired widow in Florida, but that I hadn't done really a whole lot with sort of the Florida part of her life, because a lot of the first book took place in Romania, where scammers who scammed her lived. So I thought there was plenty of rich material. I mean, Florida is rich in material. I think we have to face that. And I wanted to plunge her in that milieu. I think that's what I wanted to do.
So describe Mrs. Plansky for us.
Okay, she's from Rhode Island, does not come from a wealthy background. She was a paralegal, and her husband Norm was an engineer. They came from Rhode Island. They used to like to go camping with their kids. And one morning in the tent, Mrs. Plansky was slicing bread to make sandwiches. And she suddenly said, "Wouldn't it be nice if the knife toasted the bread while you were slicing it?" And Norm, her husband, the engineer, still in his sleeping bag, sat up quickly. And thus was born the Plansky toaster knife. So 3 years later, they had a little product that was in a lot of kitchen sales stores around the world, and they made a tidy little sum of money. They sold out, they retired, went down to Florida to enjoy their sunset years like so many others. Only he contracted one of those horrible, fast-acting cancers and died. So she's alone. There's still sort of a family that she supports. But she's quite active. She is 71, but she goes kayaking. She is a good swimmer and snorkeler and tennis player as well for her age.
So the book opens with a doubles tennis match. Tell us about this team of Mrs. Plansky and her partner, Kev.
Okay, so Norm is dead, and Mrs. Plansky used to play tennis, and Norm was her partner. They played a lot of mixed doubles together. Kev DiNardo is a member of the club, a little bit younger than Mrs. Plansky, but still old enough to play in the seniors tournament. And she is forced to admit that Kev is a better player than Norm was. And so they formed this quite formidable seniors doubles team, and they're playing in the championship match as the book opens.
So she talks a lot to her husband, to Norm, in the last book and this book, right? So who, as you mentioned, has passed on. She's sort of somewhat flirting with this idea of some kind of maybe romantic connection to Kev.
So something might happen, but I think what actually does happen is something very unexpected that leads us and Mrs. Plansky to realize that there's much more to Kev than she had thought.
Right.
Some of it not so good.
All right. She has two children, and tell about children. And then she's also got her 99-year-old father living with her, and he is a bit of a challenge.
He's living with her now, like in what used to be her office in the condo, but now it's his bedroom. Prior to that, he was in an assisted living. This was someone, he was born into a sort of money, but the fortune of what it was is all gone due to his mismanagement, but he's not very good at self-knowledge and would never connect that he's at fault for any of his own misfortune. Anyway, he was living in an assisted living, but that ended because he was dating two separate women in the assisted living, and he thought he was safe because they were on separate floors. Okay, so that a setup for disaster. So he was thrown out of the, and is now living with her. And although he's really a guest in her house, he makes her feel like she's the guest.
Right.
that's her father.
And he's the two kids, a daughter and a son.
And then there's the two kids, Jack and Nina, who are both strange, you know, early middle age, but they're still strangely reliant on her, both emotionally and certainly in Jack's case, financially to an extent.
You know, we often hear how an author will be tooling along in a story and a minor character just takes over. Did that happen to you in this book?
And this, as a writer, you've got to be so careful about this because it's almost like you're the director of a film in some ways, except that you're writing the film at the same time you're directing it. You can't let one of those characters hog all the limelight, right? Because you've lost control of your own story, even though it's all coming out of your own mind. So her father, Chandler Wills Banning, Mrs. Plansky's father, is that type of character, but he's not the one really who stepped forward and threatened to take over the book. In fact, that character isn't even human. It was.
I know what you're going to say. Fairbanks.
Fairbanks the gator. Yes, there's a gator who lives in the little lake that her condo overlooks, and Fairbanks becomes kind of a major character, even though he has no spoken dialogue whatsoever.
Talking alligator would not fit the storyline, I think.
Oh, absolutely yeah. Not.
Talk about your writing process and an active versus passive imagination.
I mean, for me, the active imagination is the part of your brain you're using when you're already starting to write the story. In other words, where you know you have an imagination and you're kind of directing it to, you know, come up with certain scenes or dialogue or something that's going to setting up something that's going to happen in the future. It's the imagination, but it's not magical. The passive imagination, where an idea comes out of the blue, and forgive me for saying magical because I don't want to shine a light unnecessarily, but I think most fiction writers have this, and it's when an idea comes out of the blue. For example, you know, the whole idea of writing about Mrs. Plansky just came to me out of the blue. I didn't try to come up with, oh, what should I write about now? What kind of character would be interesting or that people would want to read about? She just stepped fully formed into my head. And that's one of the blessings of this job. When something, you get a feeling that's all a physical feeling. It's almost like a little shiver that you're a little bit in touch with something that you've done nothing to deserve.
Now, when you started the Chet and Bernie mystery series, you took on that pen name of Spencer Quinn. And that was kind of like you didn't want it to be really attributed with you because your writing was a little different than the stories of Chet and Bernie, right? So why?
Much darker.
Yeah. So yeah. Why have you decided to keep Spencer Quinn for Mrs. Plansky books and not Peter Abrahams?
That's an excellent question. Mindy, you'll have to call marketing to talk about that. They'll have the answer. But, you know, when I handed in the first to my agent, Doggone It, which was the first of the Chet and Bernies, she said, you know, I mean, she liked it, but she said, this is so much lighter than your other work. And she said, although there's humor in your other work, it's icier. You know, this is warmer kind of thing. And she was worried that it wouldn't find the audience she thought was there. Well, I wasn't thrilled about the idea, but I thought, well, it's a two book deal. And then I'll go back to Peter Abrahams books. But what happened was, like, the 16th Chet and Bernie is coming out in April. So Spencer Quinn kind of killed Peter Abrahams, or at least locked him up. And so I said to marketing, well, indirectly, you know, through intermediaries, what about Mrs. Plansky's of Peter Abrahams? Because it's really, if you want to talk about the humor and the dark, it's in between somewhere. In other words, I'm only one person and I'm allowed to develop. That was my Anyway, it didn't fly because they said, oh, well, basically, I think they think Spencer Quinn, it's now an established thing that would be easier to market.
Yeah.
So, I hope that answers.
Yeah. So will there be any more books by Peter Abrahams, or is they going to all be Spencer Quinn?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question.
We'll have to
I
see.
I don't know. Okay. I know that I'm doing more Chet and Bernie. So I'm writing the next. Say Cat on a Hot Tin Woof comes out in April, and I'm working on the one after that right now.
Do you feel like you write differently, or the subject matter is such that you need to differentiate when you do the different names? You know, are you thinking about it when you write, or are you just...
No, I'm not at all.
Not at all.
No, okay. I get into the story and that's that. Yeah. But don't forget with the Chet and Bernie books, those are written in the first person. So, you know, when you get into that voice, it kind of takes over. And I, you know, I'm not really, I don't feel like I'm really manipulating anything.
And when you think about it, so you've got Chet and Bernie in the first person, you've got your Mrs. Plansky books, and then, you know, you've got all of your past Peter Abrahams books and the ones you've written from, you know, the ones of the 13-year-old girl, how you can get into the head of a 13-year-old girl, I find amazing, but you do. So you're able to put on all these kind of different hats when you're writing, and is that something that you're conscious of when you're doing it? Are you like when you're writing a 13-year-old girl, are you trying to think like a 13-year-old girl? I mean, what's going on in your head?
When I'm writing, I don't mean when I'm writing, like, you know, an email or something like that. But when I'm writing, you know, a story, a novel, while I'm working, there's a little physical feeling that happens in my head. And I'm in a slightly different state. I'm both writing the story and I'm witnessing it at the same time. So when I sit down in the morning to write, sometimes I'm in the middle of a chapter and I know exactly what's going to happen. And yet I'm not writing. I'm sitting there for 10 minutes doing nothing, even though I know what this is all about. And then suddenly I feel this little shift. And it's like someone plugged me in and I'm ready to go.
Yeah. Peter Abrahams, a.k.a. Spencer Quinn, is the author of Mrs. Plansky Goes Rogue. We'll have a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Peter, as always, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Mindy. Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.